With an electric torch, Samir had led Ramses rapidly through the entire collection. "In Egypt are the real treasures," Samir said. "This is but a fraction of what has been saved from pillage and from time." "Egypt," Ramses whispered. "Suddenly, I cannot see the present for the past. I can't embrace this age until I have said my farewells to those years completely." "Sire, if you desire to go to Egypt, do it now. Take Julie Stratford if you will, but leave England."
"Why do you say this?"
"The authorities know that coins have been stolen from the collection. They want to reclaim the mummy of Ramses the Great. There is much talk and suspicion."
"And this Henry Stratford knows my secret," Ramses said.
"Leave here. If you are gone, all this will die away."
"Yes, I will go. And for yourself, what is required that you might travel with us?"
"Sire, if you wish it, I will gladly go with you."
The small hours. Ramses stood in the hallway of Julie's palatial house, observing the intricately carved hands of the grandfather clock move into place. But it was time to do some work. He went into the dark, cold kitchen of the house, found a glass, as they call them, these beautiful objects, and filled it with water from the miraculous little copper tap. Then he went back into the library and studied the long row of alabaster jars under the mirror. All appeared unharmed, nothing missing. And there was his little burner, all ready for him, and the empty glass vials. He studied the jars again. His hand chose before his mind chose, and when he studied the crushed white powder, he knew that his hand had been right. As it stood now, of course, only Samir Ibrahim and Julie Stratford knew of the elixir, and they would never divulge the secret to anyone. But Lawrence Stratford had partially translated the story, and his notebook was lying about somewhere for anyone to read. This situation could not continue forever. He must carry the elixir on his person. He poured the coarse granules into the metal dish of the burner. He mixed it in the dish gently with his finger and added a liberal amount of water from the glass. Then he lighted the candle flame and gathered the glass vials and laid them out. He poured the steaming elixir into one vial after another until all four glass containers were full. And he took the candle and made the wax drip around these caps to seal them, all save one. The fourth vial, the one which he had failed to seal, he carried with him into the conservatory. He approached the potted fern nearest him, a thing of great, airy, dark green fronds. He poured a bit of the elixir into the moist soil. There was a faint stirring, a crackling sound. The leaves of the fern rustled, lengthened, tender shoots unfurled. The elixir was as strong as ever it had been. One powerful draught had rendered him immortal forever. He put the vials in his pocket. He unlatched the rear door of the house and went out into the murky, wet dawn. He could hear the city coming alive around him as he walked. From somewhere very far away, he heard a deep-throated train whistle. Suddenly, a spasm of shrill noise threw him into a panic. He turned in time to see an open motor car hurtling towards him. He fell back against the stone wall behind him as the thing rattled and bumped over the ruts in the mud. He was shaken, angry, a rare moment in which he felt helpless, exposed. Dazed, he realized he was looking at a grey dove lying dead in the street. Struck by the motor car, part of its wing had been crushed under the wheels. Suddenly a memory, one of the oldest and most vivid, caught him off guard, cruelly ripping him from the present. he was standing in the cave of the Hittite priestess. In his battle garb, his hand on the hilt of his bronze sword, he was looking up at the white doves circling in the sunlight under the high grate.
"They're immortal?"
he asked her. He spoke in the crude, guttural Hittite tongue. He had stared at her face, so old, shrunken with its deep wrinkles.
"Where is the elixir?"
he had demanded.
"You think it is a great thing? And what if all the world were filled with those who could not die, and their children, and their children's children? This cave harbors a horrid secret, I tell you. The secret of the end of the world itself."
He had drawn his sword.
"Give it to me!"
he had roared. She had not been frightened. She had smiled.
"What if it kills you, my rash Egyptian? No human being has ever drunk it, no man, woman, or child."
He stepped up to the altar. He read the words, the formula of the elixir of life, common ingredients which he himself could have gathered from the fields and riverbanks of his native land. The liquid. Look at it. With both hands, he lifted the cup and drank it down. The priestess had taken a step backwards. What had she seen? His hair stirring, writhing, as if lifted by a swift breeze, the grey hairs falling away as the strong brown hair replaced them, his black eyes fading, turning the colour of sapphires, the stunning transformation that he would verify later when he held up the glass. Ah, how light and powerful he'd felt. He could have taken flight. "Do I live or die, priestess?" And now this is London. This is 1914. He walked forward through the sludge and knelt down beside the bird and scooped it up in his hands. Ah, fragile thing. So full of life one moment, and now no more than refuse, though the white down fluttered on its warm, narrow little chest. He drew out the vial, pushed open the hinged cap, and poured the shimmering liquid over the dead creature, forcing one heavy draught after another into its open beak. Not a second passed before the thing quickened. The tiny round eyes opened, its wings flapping violently. He let it go, and up it went, circling as it soared beneath the heavy, leaden sky. He watched until it had disappeared from sight. Immortal now. To fly forever. Even before she reached the door of the conservatory, she saw the magnificent bougainvillea laden with red blossoms. And to think that yesterday she hadn't noticed these beautiful blooms. Ramses was seated in a wicker chair, watching her.
"I want to go to Egypt, Julie. Sooner or later I shall have to go to Egypt. Let it happen now."
How weary and raw he sounded. All the gentleness that had been in him yesterday was mingled now with sadness. God, how great must be his capacity for suffering. "Of course," she said. "We'll go to Egypt, you and I together."
"I want the future."
The house was in an uproar. Randolph and Alex were arguing furiously with Julie that she must not make this trip. Elliot had been sitting in Lawrence's chair in the Egyptian room, watching all this silently. But he roused himself to walk casually out to the conservatory. He extended his hand.
"Reginald Ramsay," he said, "a great pleasure. I am an old friend of the Stratford family, something of an Egyptologist myself. It is my son, Alex, who is engaged to be married to Julie."
The man hadn't known. Or he didn't understand.
Married to Julie?
He said in a half whisper. And then, with forced gaiety, he is a fortunate man, your son. The silence was becoming uncomfortable.
Now, the diary, Elliot said. He reached into his coat. This diary, it belonged to Lawrence. It has valuable information on Ramses' tomb. Notes on a papyrus left by the man, it seems. I picked it up the other night. I must put it back.
There was a sudden coldness in Ramses' face. Elliot turned.
I should like to know you, he confessed suddenly. I should like to learn from you.
He hesitated. The blue eyes fixed him in silence.
Perhaps in Cairo or Alexandria we should have some time to talk to one another. Perhaps even on shipboard.
You are going to Egypt? Ramsay asked, cocking his head.
Yes.
Politely he moved past Ramsay and into the drawing room.
Alex and I are both going.
Elliot, I told you no, Julie said.
Yes, my dear, Elliot said to Julie. But I couldn't take no for an answer. This may be the last time I see Egypt, and Alex has never been there.
Ramsay gave a soft laugh behind them.
So, we all go to Egypt, he said. I find this most interesting. We shall talk on board, Lord Rutherford, as you have said.
The dream again, but he couldn't wake up. He turned over in Daisy's bed, into the scratchy lace pillow with its cloying perfume. When he opened his eyes, he saw his father's face.
Father, he moaned, what are you doing here? I might ask you that question. Get out of that bed and get dressed. Your cousin Julie and her mysterious Egyptian friend are setting out for Alexandria this afternoon, and Elliot and Alex are going with them. Now, you will be on that ship too. Do you understand? You are Julie's cousin. You will see that things remain seemly, that nothing intervenes to prevent Julie's eventual marriage to Alex. And you will see that this man, whoever he is, does not hurt my brother's only child. See that she doesn't elope with that revoltingly handsome Egyptian.
Randolph removed a white envelope from his breast pocket and laid it on the bedside table. There was a thick wad of money in the envelope.
Don't wire me from Cairo that you're broke. Stay away from the gaming tables and the belly dancers.
It was a sumptuous first-class dining room, crowded already with gentlemen in white tie and tails and ladies in low-cut dresses, when Julie came in and took her chair. Alex rose to assist her. Henry and Elliot, already seated opposite, also rose, and though Julie nodded to Elliot, she found herself incapable of looking at her cousin. Alex, staring down at the plate before him, seemed somewhat at a loss. Was this the time or place for truth? What could she possibly say to him that would not wound him? She looked up suddenly. Ramses and Samir were here. The waiters brought the sherry now, and the soup.
"And tell me, Mr. Ramsay," Elliot said smoothly, "you knew our Lawrence in Cairo."
"Our Lawrence. Briefly, I knew him."
Ramses was staring at Henry.
"Yes, well, if he were here, he'd be talking about his beloved mummy," said Alex with a nervous laugh.
Henry reached for his drink suddenly and knocked it over.
"Tell me, Mr. Ramsay," said Elliot, "your personal opinion, if you will. Is this mummy truly Ramses the Great? An immortal who lived until the time of Cleopatra?"
"What do you think, Lord Rutherford?" Ramses asked. "You read the notes of your friend Lawrence. Is there an immortal man in that mummy case in Julie's house in Mayfair?"
Elliot smiled.
"No, there isn't," he said. "Lord Rutherford, you were a good friend of Lawrence, were you not?"
"Yes, we were very good friends," Elliot answered. "And we did agree upon one thing. We wanted my son to marry his daughter.
Julie was stunned. Elliot, please. Ramses laughed, but he was now angry. Julie could feel it.
Lawrence believed that it was Julie's choice. Let me see, how did he put it?
He turned his eyes on Henry.
Ah, yes. Julie's marriage can wait forever. My dear Henry, were those not his words?
Henry's lips worked silently, but only a faint moan came out of his lips. He rose from the chair, upsetting it, and half stumbled towards the far door. Julie could take no more.
I don't want any more talk of marriage.
She gathered up her small evening bag and walked slowly through the dining room. She was crying when he came into her stateroom.
Let it be for now, Ramses, she said desperately. I can't bear the knowledge that he did it. Let it be, I beg you. I only want us to be in Egypt together.
Come out with me, he said in a low, soft voice, kissing her tenderly on the shoulder. The wind is cool and fresh, and they are playing music in the public rooms. Come with me, my queen.
From the deep shadows of the darkly paneled bar, Elliot watched them dancing. They were going into the third waltz now, and Julie was laughing as Ramsay led her recklessly and madly, driving the other dancers out of his path. No one seemed to take offense at it. Everyone respects those who are in love. By the fourth day out, Elliot realized that Julie would not dine again in the public rooms, that she would take all her meals in her stateroom from now on, and that Ramsay was probably dining with her. Henry had also disappeared from view altogether. Sullen, drunk, he remained in his room round the clock. Elliot could also see that Julie was going out of her way to be gentle with Alex. She and Alex took their afternoon walk on the deck, rain or shine. Clearly, it had been agreed that Alex should not be neglected by Julie. The real adventure of the voyage for Elliot was getting to know Ramsay, and watching Ramsay from afar and realizing things about Ramsay which others didn't appear to notice. It helped immensely that Ramsay was a ferociously social being. Modern science interested this Ramsay in particular. Almost every night he was in the library, poring over Darwin and Malthus, or popular compendiums on electricity, the telegraph, the automobile, and astronomy. Ramsay typed by the hour lists of what he meant to do, some of which Elliot managed to glimpse on trips to Ramsay's cabin. Common enough were entries such as visit the Prado in Madrid, ride in an aeroplane as soon as possible. On one very eerie morning, Elliot entered the ballroom to see a handful of musicians playing steadily for Ramsay, who danced alone, a curious, slow, and primitive dance, much like that of Greek men today in their seaside tavernas. That Ramsay was so accessible, that was a great surprise, but the oddest part of the whole exhilarating affair was how much Elliot was coming to like this mysterious creature. It had been another perfect night. Alex had retired early, and Julie had been left alone to dance with Ramses for hours. She drank a little too much wine. Now, as they stood in the tiny, low-ceilinged passage outside her stateroom, she felt as always the wrenching temptation and the desperation that she mustn't give in to it. It caught her utterly off guard when Ramses spun her around, crushed her to his chest, and kissed her more roughly than usual. There was a painful urgency to it. "Why do you try to force me?" she said. The look in his eyes frightened her.
"I'm hungry," he said, all semblance of courtesy lost. "Hungry for you, for everything, but above all, for you."
His voice grew quieter.
"I wait for you to love me, if that is what is required."
She laughed suddenly.
"But you have it backwards," she said. "What is required is that you love me."
24 hours, the navigator had told him, and we shall dock in Alexandria. It was Cleopatra he saw. He saw the conference room in the palace of long ago, and she, the young queen, young as Julie Stratford was now, conversing with her ambassadors and advisers. All night long they'd made love. The windows had been open to the sea. She had been as hungry for him as he had been for her, for though he had had 100 women in the preceding months, he loved only Cleopatra. "What is it you really want of me, Ramses?" she had asked. "That you be a good and wise queen of Egypt, I've told you. You want more than that. You're preparing me for something much more important." "No," he said, but that had been a lie. "I'm lonely, my beloved. I am lonely beyond mortal endurance." But he didn't say that to her. He only stood there, knowing that he, an immortal man, could not live without her. The lovers would come. Julius Caesar would come. And then the one who swept her away from all the things he'd taught her. "For Egypt," she'd cry. But it wasn't for Egypt. Egypt was Cleopatra then. And Cleopatra was for Antony. Eliot could see in the very first hour of their arrival that Alexandria was a profound shock to Ramsay. His vitality seemed sapped. That night at dinner, when the subject of Henry's abrupt departure for Cairo was raised, he was almost snappish. "Julie Stratford's a grown woman," he said, glancing at her. "It's preposterous to think that she requires the constant companionship of a drunken, dissolute being. Are we not, as you say, gentlemen?"
"I suppose so," Alex responded with predictable brightness. "And when do we go on the Nile steamer?" Alex asked Ramsay. "How much time do you need in this city, old boy?"
"Not very much," Ramsay said dismally. "There is little left of the old Roman times which I hope to see." He was a man alone in the midst of a struggle. Academy of the ancient world, this city. And now it was a seaside resort. The hotel stood on the very spot where her palace had been, where he had taken her in his arms and begged her to stop her mad passion for Mark Antony. "The man will fail, don't you see?" he had pleaded. "He's weak, corrupt. He lacks the metal." She didn't care. She loved Mark Antony. Egypt, Rome, what did it matter? When had she ceased to be the queen and become the mere mortal? Oh, stop the voices of the past. Listen only to the sea. Walk where the old Roman cemetery stood, where they laid her to rest beside Mark Antony. And now, all trace of her was gone. Oh, but she could have been immortal. The catacombs. Why had he asked Julie to come with him? He needed her there. And to think, he had told her nothing.
"Look," she said. "There's a window there, cut high up in the rock. How amazing! And an altar."
He stared into the gloom at the great rectangular stone to which she pointed. No, not an altar. A bed. A bed where he had lain for 300 years until that portal high up there had been opened. He heard Cleopatra's girlish voice. "Ramses, rise. A queen of Egypt calls to you." Soft, dusty rays falling down from the 20th century world outside. The roar of motor cars on the boulevards of the modern city of Alexandria.
"Ramses?"
He turned. Julie Stratford was looking up at him. "My beautiful one," he whispered. He took her in his arms, tenderly. Not passion, but love. Yes, love. "My beautiful Julie." They had been heading up the Nile for the better part of the afternoon, the sun beating down with full force upon the striped awnings of the small, elegant steamer. They did not know how long their cruise would be, but shepherds, the old standby of the British abroad, would be waiting. Late afternoon, they went ashore at Luxor and took the long stroll through the immense temple complex. Were these ruins already when you last saw them?
Yes, they were, and covered over with sand so deep that only the very tops of the columns were visible. The avenue of the sphinxes was buried entirely. 1,000 years had passed since I walked in this place, a mortal man, a fool, who thought the kingdom of Egypt was the civilized world, and that no truth lay outside its boundaries. Someday, I'm going to tell you all of it, he said. But come, there's time for us to cross the river and ride out to the temple of Ramses the Third. I want so much to see it.
Abu Simbel. They had come at last to the greatest of Ramses' temples. Alone they stood, she and Ramses, under the star-filled sky, the desert wind faintly howling. Far off, she saw the lighted tent of their little camp waiting for them. Into the temple they walked, past the giant legs of the pharaoh god. If there were tears in Ramses' eyes, the wind carried them away, but his sigh she heard. Where did you go when your reign had ended?
All over the world. I was a legend by then, the human phantom who spoke only to the rulers of Egypt. It was seen as a great blessing when I appeared.
But no one knew you, or knew about your immortality. She shook her head. I don't know how you could bear it.
Well, I could bear it no more, he said dejectedly. Even gods get lonely. I made a coward's bargain, finally. I'd go into the tomb, into the darkness, which I knew by then would mean a gradual weakening, and then a deep sleep from which I couldn't awake. But the priests who served the royal house would know where I lay, and that sunlight could resurrect me. They would give the secret to each new ruler of Egypt, with the warning that if I were awakened, it must be to serve the good of Egypt. And woe to anyone rash enough to wake me for curiosity only, or with evil intentions, because then I might take my revenge. I had become legend. Ramses the damned, Ramses the immortal, who slept in the cave waiting for a brave king or queen of Egypt to wake him. I don't think they believed it any more, not really. Until Cleopatra.
But Ramses, did she really refuse the elixir?
In her own way she refused it. You see, she couldn't understand what it was. She begged me to give it to Mark Antony, but she didn't know what she was asking. Would Antony not have wanted immortal armies?
Good God, she whispered.
Maybe I dreamed that someday I'd be awakened again to a new world, to new and wise beings. Maybe I dreamed of someone who would take the challenge. And I would be the lone wanderer no more. Ramses the damned would become once again Ramses the Immortal.
He looked down at her and lifted her as he kissed her. With her whole soul, she yielded. She felt his arm gathering her up as he carried her to the tent and the flickering firelight. Incense here, the smell of candles. He set her down on silken pillows, on a carpet of dark woven flowers, a bower he had made for her, for himself. For this moment. I love you, Julie Stratford, he whispered in her ear. My English queen. His kisses were paralyzing her. Luxuriating in this helplessness, she let him rip away the chemise and the corset. She lay naked, looking up at him as he knelt over her, peeling off his own garments. Regal he seemed, his chest gleaming in the light. She felt his weight come down upon her, crushing her. I am yours forever, she whispered.
It was almost dawn. They had left the warmth of the tent hours ago and come here into the deserted temple with only the loose silk sheets around them. They had made love in the sand over and over. And then he had lain in the dark, looking up at the stars, the king who had built this house. I want to visit the pyramids, the museum, what one must visit, said Ramses to Julie. And then I want to be gone from here.
Yes, I understand. She motioned for him to take the chair beside her. I want to be gone too, she said.
She gave him a quick, soft kiss on the lips. We won't be in Cairo more than a few days, I promise.
Ramses, she said, you have to forgive me, but Alex wants to see the opera in Cairo, and so does Elliot. I promised we would.
Of course. This opera, something I should see, perhaps?
Yes, she said. It's an Egyptian story written by an Italian. It's called Aida. I think you'll like it.
Many instruments?
Yes, she laughed. And many voices.
This had been a Mameluke house, a little palace of sorts, crammed with the Eastern exotica and big, comfortable old pieces of Victorian furniture. He had everything he wanted. Malenka kept him fed on the delicious spiced dishes he craved when he was sick from drink. His winnings had been good for a straight 10 days, and he'd kept the card game going from noon until late in the evening. At night, he and Malenka made love in the big Victorian bed, which she loved. As soon as Julie and her escorts arrived, he was heading on to America, San Francisco. He could take Malenka with him, and out there in California, who would give a damn that her skin was darker than his? Her skin. He loved Malenka's skin. Smoky, hot Malenka. This was exactly what he wanted life to be. The game, the drink, the utter seclusion. And a warm, voluptuous woman who'd strip off her clothes when he snapped his fingers. He was annoyed when they brought the telegram to the door. He never should have left his address at Shepherd's. But then he had no choice. How else could he have gotten the money his father telegraphed? Cairo. This had been desert in Ramses' time. Now it was a metropolis, bigger even than Alexandria. The British section looked for all the world like a part of London. Shepherd's Hotel was a tropical palace with broad porches, replete with wicker slatted blinds, and big Egyptian artifacts thrown in among the English furnishings, the whole crowded with the same rich tourists he'd seen everywhere. Through the broad dusty rooms of the museum they trekked, listening to the guide. They proceeded up the grand stairway to the room of the kings, a great chamber of glass cases, like the cases in the department stores where goods were displayed safe from prying fingers. Nevertheless, the blackened, grinning bodies gave him a dull shock. If he had not gone into the cave with the wicked old priestess, he would indeed be lying in this case, or what was left of him. The guide had stopped at the end of the hall. What was it now?
Unknown woman, a curious example of natural preservation.
Let's go, he said. He stepped forward and gave Julie's sleeve a little tug and glanced down at the body in the case as he did so. His heart stopped.
Though most of the wrappings were long ago torn away in the search for valuables, no doubt, the woman's body was perfectly preserved by the delta mud, much as bodies found in the northern bogs.
He looked down through the glass. Her face. It was she, the soft cerements molded into her flesh, her naked hands gently curved, her feet bare, the wrappings loose around her ankles. All black,
black as the Delta mud which had surrounded her, preserved her, hardened her. Ramses, what is it? They were speaking to him from all sides. They were surrounding him, and Elliot with those sad grey eyes, watching him. Legs no more than bones. The fingers of her right hand a skeleton. But that beautiful face. My Cleopatra. Julie spoke words. The lights were soft in the room at Shepherd's Hotel. He wanted to answer, but he couldn't. "Won't you try to explain?" she whispered. "It's not possible that it's she." "Not possible," his voice an agonized whisper. "We don't have to stay in Cairo any longer, if you don't want." "No, we cannot leave, not now. I don't want to leave." He rose and walked slowly out of the room, not even glancing back at her. She heard his tread in the hall, and then her tears flowed again. It was long past midnight. Elliot walked alone in the dark courtyard between the two wings of Shepherd's Hotel. His left leg was now going numb, but he paid no heed to it. Now and then he glanced up at the figure pacing in the suite above, a shadow moving back and forth across the slatted blinds. Ramsay. The figure stopped. It moved to the blinds. Then Ramsay disappeared altogether. Elliot turned and hobbled awkwardly towards the doors to the lobby. He saw Ramsay come down the grand staircase and make for the doors. Gripping his cane, he made to follow. He saw the dark figure walking fast across the square. The pain was bad, but he pressed on. In a few short blocks, Ramsay had reached the museum. In the yellow light of the alcove, the guard snored blissfully. The door was open. Elliot slowly entered the museum. A grey, murky light filled the corridor. There stood Ramsay beside the low, shallow display case in which the mass of the dead woman in her petrified rags gleamed like black coal. "Dear God, he cannot mean to do this." Helplessly, he watched as Ramsay broke loose the light wood-framed glass lid so that he might touch the dead thing inside. With sudden speed, he produced the vial. The gleaming white liquid flowed in droplets down on the corpse as Ramsay passed the vial back and forth above it. In horror and fascination, he watched Ramsay bend tenderly, as if placing the glittering vial to her mouth. A hiss echoed through the darkness. Ramsay stumbled back, pressing himself to the wall. The vial fell from his hand and rolled to the stone floor, a tiny bit of fluid still shimmering inside it. Movements of the dark mass in the low, shallow bed of the case. "Dear God, man, what have you done? What have you awakened?" The thing inside the case was stirring, rising. The thing stood square on its feet. Its great head of shaggy black hair poured down like thick smoke. Ramsay moved backwards, away from it. A desperate prayer escaped him, full of the old Egyptian names of the gods. Its bare feet scratching the stones with the rough, dry sound of rats in the walls, the figure lowered its arms and reached towards Ramsay. The light shone in its huge, staring eyes, the eyelids eaten away, the hair thickening and writhing as it grew sleeker and blacker and tumbled down longer over the bony shoulders. But, dear God, what were the patches of white all over it? The bones, the bare bones where the flesh had been torn away. Bare bones showing in the left leg, in the right foot, in the fingers, struggling to reach Ramsay. "It's not whole. You've raised a thing which is not whole." As Ramsay backed away again, passing Elliot, half stumbling towards the far railing of the stair, the thing came on, gaining speed until it reached the sunlight. It turned and rocked on its feet, drinking up the light. The blood began to ooze from the torn wounds that everywhere exposed the skeleton. Elliot closed his eyes. For one moment he almost lost consciousness. He was aware of noise below, a door slamming far to the back of the huge building. He opened his eyes to see the thing drawing nearer. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw Ramses plastered to the rail of the stairs, staring in undisguised horror.
God in heaven, drive it back!
Elliot felt the burning in his chest, the familiar tightening. The pain shot down his left arm, and with all his strength he clutched the silver cane. He willed himself to breathe, to remain standing. Its eyes were fixed on the man at the end of the hall. Its breath came in heaves. Its mouth became a grimace. Noise from below, the shrill sound of a whistle. Ramses reeled. Their shouts could only mean that they had seen him. In panic, he turned back to the female figure, drawing ever closer.
Ramses!
It was the cry of a wounded animal. Again, Elliot almost lost consciousness. He could hear the sounds of the guards dragging Ramses down the stairs. Now all sound had died away below. Ruthless, ignoring the pain in his chest, Elliot hurried down the corridor. He reached the side door in time to see the female at the foot of a service stairs. He turned back, glancing under the display cases. There lay the vial, still gleaming in the grey light. Going down on one knee, he got hold of it, and closing its cap, he put it in his coat. He crept down the stairs after the female. Halfway down, he saw her, bewildered, staggering, one claw-like hand out, groping in the dimness. A door opened suddenly, and a servant woman emerged, draped in the Muslim manner by a garment of black wool. As she saw the skeletal figure approaching, she let out a shrill scream, a mop falling from her hands. A low hiss came out of the wounded one as she went after the serving maid, hands out as if to stop the piercing scream. Elliot moved as fast as he could. The scream stopped before he reached the door. As he entered, he saw the body of the servant woman slumping, dead, to the floor, her neck apparently broken, and the flesh torn from her cheek. Quickly he closed the door of the room behind him. The noise startled her. She wheeled about, hands poised again for the attack. For a moment he was paralyzed by the full horror of what he now beheld. Her eyes bulged from their half-eaten sockets. White rib bones gleamed through a huge wound in her side. Half of her mouth was gone, and a bare stretch of clavicle was drenched in oozing blood. Giving a low growl, she advanced on him, but Elliot spoke quickly in Greek.
"Friend," he said, "I am a friend, and offer you shelter."
And as his mind went blank on the ancient tongue, he switched to the Latin.
"Trust in me. I shall not let you come to harm."
Not taking his eyes off her, he groped for one of several black cloaks hanging on the wall, worn by Muslim women in public. They were large enough to drape her from head to toe. Closing the door to conceal the dead body, he led her out into the alleyway, where the bright sun came down upon them. They entered the great endless crowds of Cairo. Thousands of pedestrians moving in all directions, despite the blast of motor car horns and the progress of donkey-drawn carts. The Latin word for food came from her in a low, tortured voice.
"Yes," he said in her ear,
the Latin words coming easily now that he knew that she understood them.
"I shall take care of you. Trust in me."
But where could he take her? Only one place came to mind. He had to reach old Cairo. Seeing a horse-drawn cab passing, he hailed it. She climbed to the leather seat. Near to collapse, he slumped down beside the hunched figure and told the driver where he must go. The cab shot forward, the driver shouting and cracking his whip. The poor creature beside him cried broken-heartedly, drawing the veil completely over her face. He embraced her. He ignored the cold, hard bone he could feel through the thin black cloth. He held tight to her, and gradually catching his breath, told her again in Latin that he would care for her, that he was her friend. As the cab sped out of the British district, he tried to think, but shocked and in pain, he could achieve no rational explanation for himself for what he'd witnessed or what he'd done. He only knew that he'd seen a miracle,
and a murder, and that the former meant infinitely more to him than the latter, and he was set now on an irrevocable course. Ramses dropped down into the street and ran from his captors. Finally, he stepped into a doorway and rested, and then slowly slipped his hand into his coat. He felt the broad strip of the money belt. The vials were intact. Never in all his existence had he experienced the regret he was feeling now. But it was done. He had succumbed to the temptation. He had awakened the half-rotted body lying in that case. He must learn whether a spark of intellect existed inside it. A disguise, that is what he needed. The carriage had been unable to get close to the house. It was only a few paces more. Elliot looked at her eyes again. Yes, the eyelids had filled in somewhat, and long, beautiful black lashes were now curving upwards, hiding the ruined flesh. He was aware suddenly of a perfume rising from her, a rich, sweet, and altogether lovely perfume. He could feel her warmth coming through the black serge.
Dear God, what is this potion? What is it capable of? There, my dear, he said in English, that door at the end.
He felt her arm slip around him. With a powerful grip, she lifted him slightly, taking the pressure off his numb left foot. The pain in his left hip slackened. He gave a little laugh of relief, allowing her to assist him until he reached the door. He pounded it with his right fist. There was a long moment in which he heard nothing. He pounded again and again. Then came the sound of the bolts sliding, and Henry appeared, squinting, his face unshaven, dressed only in a green silk robe.
"Let me in!"
He pushed the door back and brought the woman with him into the room. Desperately, she crowded against him, hiding her face. Dimly, he saw that the place was luxurious, carpets, furniture, decanters gleaming on a marble bar. Through the archway, a dark-skinned beauty in a satin dancing costume, obviously Malenka, had just set down a tray of steaming food. Small orange trees crowded against the whitewashed garden wall. Henry was staring at the woman's feet. He'd seen the bare bones showing in the instep. Convulsively, Henry moved back, slamming into the pillar that divided the archway to the courtyard, his head thudding dangerously against the stone.
"What's wrong with her?" he gasped. "Patience, I'll tell you everything," Elliot whispered.
He felt the woman's grip loosen and realized she had seen the glass bottles gleaming in the light from the yard. She went towards the liquid, groaning. The black serge garment fell from her head and then her shoulders, fully revealing the bones of her ribs, bleeding through the gaping holes in her back and the remnants of the cloth that barely concealed her nakedness.
"For the love of God, don't panic!"
Elliot shouted. But it was too late. Henry's face went white, his mouth twisted and shuddering. Behind him, in the courtyard, Malenka let out a full-throated scream. Henry's hand rose from his pocket, sun glinting on the barrel of a small gun.
"No, Henry!" Elliot cried.
He tried to rise, but he couldn't. The shot exploded. The wounded woman let out a great bellow as she ran at Henry. The sounds coming from Henry were scarcely human. He backed into the courtyard, firing the gun again and again and again. Crying in agony, the woman closed on him, taking him by the throat. In an ugly waltz, they struggled, Henry clawing at her desperately, her bony fingers holding fast to his neck. The wicker table went over, china shattering on the tiles. In terror, Malenka crouched against the wall.
"Elliot, help me!"
Henry screamed. He was bent over backwards, knees buckling and hands flailing. Elliot reached the edge of the archway in time to hear the bones snap. He saw Henry's body go limp and tumble to the ground softly in a heap of green silk. The creature staggered backwards, her mouth making a grimace again, teeth bared. Her eyes, bloodshot and running with tears, stared at the dead body and then at the spilt food, the hot tea steaming in the sun. She went down on her knees. She grabbed up the muffins and stuffed them into her mouth. She lapped the spilt tea. She scraped up the jam with her fingers and sucked at them frantically. In utter silence, Elliot watched her.
He was vaguely conscious of Malenka running silently towards him and then hovering behind him. Deliberately, he took one breath after another, listening to the hammer trip of his heart. Finally, there was no more food. Yet she remained there, on her knees, staring at her outstretched hands. The sun beat down on the little courtyard. Suddenly the creature turned and lay down on the paved ground. She stared up into the burning sky.
"Ramses," she whispered.
The Earl turned and reached for Malenka. Leaning heavily on her, he struggled back towards the chair. Malenka's eyes were wide and empty, her mouth agape. She stared towards the garden. Flies circled over Henry's face. They swooped down on the remnants of the overturned meal.
"No police,"
Malenka pleaded in a barely audible voice.
"I take my English away. No police come."
"Yes. All right." He sighed, and the pain in his chest intensified. He brought out his money clip and took out 2 £10 notes. Then he lay back again and closed his eyes. Malenka's hand touched him lightly.
"You cover," she whispered,
her eyes gesturing to the yard.
"I cover,"
he whispered, and closed his eyes again. With great relief, he heard her go out. In long flowing Bedouin robes, Ramses walked through the museum, among the milling tourists, peering ahead through the dark glasses at the empty space where the display case had stood. No sign that it had ever been there. No broken glass, no splintered wood, and the vial he had dropped, gone. He could not think where to go or what to do. If he did not discover something soon, he would go completely mad. Elliot took a few cautious steps towards the woman asleep on the tiled patio floor. She moaned uneasily. A large patch of white bone gleamed through her raven hair, and the wound in her chest was still there, gaping, revealing a stretch of white ribs overlaid with a thin membrane full of tiny red veins. But the face had assumed its full human contour. High color bloomed in the beautifully molded cheeks. The mouth was exquisitely shaped and ruddy. She had sat up. He led her through the little house and into the bedroom. He opened the blinds opposite the bed, letting the full heat come in. Then he hurried to close the door to the sitting room, and he peered out the window that opened onto the yard. Malenka was just opening the garden gate. Two men had come in with a rolled-up carpet. They unrolled it on the pavement, lifted up the body of Henry, dumped it down on the carpet, and rolled it up again. Elliot went back to the woman on the bed and looked down at her. He could not tell if the healing was continuing, and then he thought of the vial in his coat. She looked up at him, squinting, as though the brightness hurt her, and softly in Latin she asked his name.
"Forgive me," he said in Latin. "Elliot, Lord Rutherford, in my land I am a lord. May I ask your name?"
A bitter smile came over her.
"Cleopatra," she said. "In my land, I am a queen."
The silence shimmered. He stared into her eyes, unable to answer. And then a great exhilaration seized him, obliterating every fear and regret of his soul. In Latin, she said,
"Speak to me in English, Lord Rutherford, and you must tell me..."
She started. The pain in her side hurt her, and then, frantically, she touched the wound in her head.
"Tell me."
She was obviously struggling to remember. Then panic seized her, and clamping her hands to her head, she closed her eyes and started to weep.
"Here, wait, I have the medicine," he whispered.
A half inch of fluid remained in it. She pointed to her eyelids, and he saw that there were still small places where the skin appeared eaten away. She took the vial from him, poured a drop or two onto her fingers, and smoothed this on her lids. Now, desperately, she took the whole vial and poured the fluid over the gaping hole in her chest. She smeared it with her left fingers, whimpering softly, and then lay back, gasping faintly, head tossing on the pillow, then still. It was only just penetrating to him that she was Cleopatra, that Ramses had stumbled upon the body of his lost love. "I'll get more of the medicine. You must lie here in the sun." Her eyes went dim for a moment, and then she moaned aloud in pure distress again. The gramophone. Ramsay loved music. Elliot wound the box and set the needle on the record. At the first thin sound of the orchestra, she sat up in the bed. She stared in horror.
Opera. Aida. The song was from a man to his Egyptian love.
She began to moan in time with the music, and then to dance, rocking frantically from side to side. Elliot had seen this very kind of dancing before, among severely damaged children, an atavistic response to rhythm and sound. Ramses bought the newspaper from the British newsstand and walked on slowly through the crowded bazaar. The headline read, "Murder in the Museum. Mummy Stolen. Maid Killed." Beneath the headline was the column heading, "Mysterious Egyptian Sought in Grisly Death." What was he to do? In the hot, teeming street, he found himself whispering the old prayer under his breath. Samir. Samir would know how to help. She sat on the side of the bed, eating from the tray he put before her on the small wicker table from the yard. The creature's appetite was fierce, and she ate almost savagely. He slipped away now and went in search of Malenka. He found her crouched, shivering, in the sitting room. She stared at him, dull-eyed, and then turned her head to the wall.
"My poor English is in the boiling vat by now."
"What vat? What are you saying?"
"My beautiful English. They make a mummy of him for tourists to buy. They wrap him in linen. They make him a king."
She asked again, "What was this place?"
"Egypt," he told her.
He had told her over and over. Then would come the blank look, then the look of pain. Timidly, he lifted the brush and brought it down through her hair. Lovely, fine hair. A low laugh came from between her lips.
"Very good, Lord Rutherford," she said in English. "Bella Regina Cleopatra," he sighed.
He puzzled over it. One moment, she was a deeply afflicted creature he must care for. The next, the great Cleopatra. She drew closer to him. Her fingers stroked his hair. Dear God, the same flesh that had laid rotted and black beneath that dirty glass. Her lips touched his suddenly. Her mouth opened against his, and he felt her tongue sliding between her teeth. Instantly, his sex stirred. But this was madness. He was incapable. His heart, the pain in his bones, he could not possibly. She pushed her breasts against him. Cleopatra, the lover of Caesar, of Antony, and of Ramses the Damned. He closed his arms around her waist. She went back on the lace pillows, pulling him down on top of her.
"Oh, take me, Lord Rutherford," came her hissing whisper.
"And this is how I die. Not from the horrors I've beheld, but from this." He kissed